Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Sock Them Asia podcast. I am your host. My name is Cassie, and I'm joined by my co-host. Hi, Carlos.
Hello.
Yes. Hi, so, Cassie. Yes. And I'm very excited because we have a current events podcast, which means that we're going to be talking about something that's happening, something that's going to happen. And I'm also doubly excited because the resource person that we have today is a veteran journalist. But before I get into that, we're going to be talking all about the upcoming elections happening in Nepal. So we're recording this podcast on the 13th of November, and the general elections will be held on the 20th. So, very, very exciting. And we're going to wait and see if the things that we talk about today will be, you know, prophetic or not. But I'm not the best person to talk about that. So I'm going to introduce the person who is. So our guest today, he's currently the editor of The Sanchar, which is a journalistic multimedia venture in Nepal. And he is a veteran journalist who has written for different media outlets like India Today, Outlook, The Telegraph, and Indian Express. We're so honored to have him, and I'm so excited to pick his brain. So Yuvaraj Gimire, welcome to the podcast. We're so honored to have you with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Yes. So like we said in the introduction of this podcast, Nepal has a general election coming up. So can you tell us a little bit about how you're feeling? Because correct me if I'm wrong, but you will also be voting in this upcoming election. So this might be very exciting for you as a citizen and a journalist.
Yes, this is an exciting moment for not me alone. I'm a journalist, I'm a citizen, but 30 million people, out of which 17.9 million are voters. And for them, this is an opportunity that democracy offers to elect their rulers for 5 years. And this is the second election in a row under the new constitution, which was promulgated in 2015. But there are certain misgivings and frustrations also. But, you know, people, after all, they go for an informed choice or decision to, give a message to political parties, to the contestants, to big leaders and all that. I think this is people's time. This is going to be people's time in Nepal. And so there is, I'll say that, there is massive excitement. Mm-hmm. They are in a decisive mood.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the hot issues that do you think will be the very deciding points for the upcoming election?
Well, one major issue that we see, and also resentment among the large scale voters, is level of corruption that prevails in the country. In a way, I can say that the transparent nature of corruption in Nepal, if there is one thing which is very transparent, it is corruption. And no party, major parties, I mean, when I say major parties, in the current context, there are three. Mm-hmm. Congress, that currently leads the coalition, ruling coalition, Nepal Communist Party, United Marxist-Leninist, led by K.P. Woolley, who has been prime minister twice in the past, and Nepal Communist Party Maoist Center, which is led by Puspa Kamal Dahal Prachanda, who also led a decade-long insurgency for radical change in Nepal from 1996 to 2006. And this Maoist Center is currently in the ruling coalition led by Nepali Congress. There is a public resentment, one, on corruption, as I told you, large degree of impunity. Third, poor delivery in terms of, the big gap, prevailing gap between what they promised during the last election and offered, or what they didn't offer. And fourth is the kind of political instability, despite UML and Maoist Party together winning the poll with 2/3 majority in the last election, that alliance broke away. Mm-hmm. there has been political instability. So people are fed up. And one major indicator this time is, you know, like a large number of, there are, in Nepal's election system is a big system. There are, this election is going to take place for federal parliament as well as 7 provincial legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Out of 275 seats in federal parliament, 165 is going to be elected under the first past the post system, for which election is going to take place on November 20. Of course, other elections also. And another one, remaining 110 would be filled up under the proportional representation system.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the provincial, out of 500 total seats, 330, I guess, are under the first past the post system and the remaining under the PR system. So it's so results might come, and for the direct seats, the results might come within a week of the poll taking place on November 20. But for others, it might take some time, which the Election Commission hasn't specified yet.
Mm.
But people are waiting with bated breath about the outcome, with all the hope, you know, that frustration that they are having, but it's also, there is also an element of hope inside our fate for the coming 5 years.
Mr. Gimiri, is there, I'm just asking, you know, if, is there a feeling that are there fears that the, you know, the Nepali democracy, or as it is, might be threatened with this kind of uncertainties, given that, you know, it's, although Nepal has had democratic periods in its long history, but this period post the monarchy is just less than 15 years. So are there fears that, given the issues that you've said, that the problems that happened prior to the declaration of the elections, and of course the problem with waiting for results of the election, are there fears that there might be some questions or doubts that might, you know, happen or occur, or anomalies that might occur, thrown by critics or by of whoever loses the election at the process itself?
Well, yeah, that is one tragedy, or, you know, one very negative aspect of elections, not only in Nepal, but in other South Asian countries also. Democracy is not just the label. It is also the way of behavior of individual citizens, of political parties, of big leaders. We have seen in the past that political parties who have lost the polls, they question the credibility of the electoral process and outcome. Yes, in the past, many times, process have been compromised. So that has brought into question the legitimacy of that system and democratic nature of the political parties or their leaders. Yes, it's a very vast question that you've asked. Nepal became a republic in 2008, in 2006, after the radical political change took place in Nepal, monarchy was put under suspension. Simultaneously, Nepal also went through a peace process, because Maoist insurgents who had raised arms against the state, they came to join the democratic and peace process. Yes, there was certain reservation that time and even now, that if there is a conflict that is to be resolved, you involve all sides of the conflict, because Maoists raise arms against monarchy and democratic political parties. Exclusion of monarchy from the peace process was something Nepalese had reservation about, because there was huge and powerful international community involved, and they had their one way. And also, one predicament or problem that a smaller country faces from the big neighbors, Nepal has China on one side, although China was not very interfering in Nepal's internal affairs, there was
mm-hmm.
side. And India has larger influence on Nepal. Some of them are, Chinian, and some of them are the borderline, the interference. In Nepal's case, what India said, was if Nepal goes through conflict, that conflict, Nepal, in that 10 year, Nepal lost 17,000 human lives. There were 7 to 8 people, being killed every day by the state or the insurgents. So this kind of conflict will have a spillover effect in neighboring India. To that extent, it was Jinin, and they took the initiative to, establish peace or bring the Maoists to the negotiation table. They succeeded. India also took a lead role in, getting European Union and the US on board. But what they did was they took a stand that, somehow they played a role in excluding the monarchy from the peace process. I think that is the reason why peace process is not at conflict, in the sense that transitional justice has not been, achieved. The victims are yet to get justice, victims from Maoist side as well as, anti-Maoist side. So this failure cast its shadow on the enthusiasm of the people, even in this election. You signed the peace agreement in 2006, November, exactly 16 years ago, but you have not been able to deliver the transitional justice, and you have not been able to bring to justice those who committed in a gross human rights violation. That is something which is an issue in this time. But two major, two signatories in the peace negotiation, the Congress and the Maoist Party, are together in the coalition. We really don't know. Nepal's coalition has a very fragile nature. How long they will be together in the government or outside?
Mm-hmm.
This pre-election equation may not continue after the election if Nepal's new parliament is going to be a hung one, with no parties getting absolute majority. And I think that is the likely case in our outcome. But mm-hmm. yet, there is resentment about the resentment with the leaders on this count also. You didn't include all sides of the conflict in the peace process. That's why this instability in Nepal's political and peace process.
Mr. Kibirik, for outsiders, can you also give a description of the coalitions heading into the election? Because for us, we see, for example, although there's a multi-party elections, from our vantage point for outsiders, we see most of the parties, at least on paper, are either from center to the left. You know, it's something different from most experience from other countries, that they usually have right and then the left. But here, it's mostly the big parties, at least, are mostly on professed to be center left to the left. Can you describe what the coalitions are that have been formed for the elections, and what are their agenda heading into the elections?
Thank you. It's very important, question. Yes, Nepali Congress at the moment leads the coalition, and it is also leading the election coalition, in which I mentioned that Maoist Party is there. Maoist Party is it used to be an ultra-left party, and now you can call it left of the center party. The Nepali Congress is, has professed in its manifesto all the characters of, at least in manifesto, it's a social democratic party, but left parties call it, slightly right of the center. And then we have UML, which is leading another coalition, which is left of the center party. And we have another party, pro-monarchy party, called Rashtriya Prajatantra Party, that is aligned with the UML. And that party demands revival of the monarchy as a guardian in a country with diversity, ethnic diversity, diversity based on faith, then this geographical diversity and all that. So what I'm saying is, despite political party describing their commitment in nature, there is a very, very contradictory nature of alliance also in this election's political, race. So UBL basically led by Oli, but also on foreign policy approach. It's a very mixed because, on foreign policy approach, Nepali Congress, that has been in power, in leadership, maximum number of years from 1990 political change when Nepal became a multi-party democracy, maintains more or less, a stable relationship with the democratic governments of the world, like neighboring India or United States or UK and all that. Maoist, although in the coalition with Nepali Congress, is basically given their background and the fact that they came from armed revolution background, they do tend to give message that they have their revolutionary intact, both at the domestic level and in terms of relations with the world outside. They do shift there. So sometimes, they criticize the US in the context of Venezuela. But sometimes they support economic policy there is one very controversial project this is MCC, Millennium Challenge Corporation, under which US was to give $500 million to Nepal ostensibly for its development of energy and infrastructure. There was huge controversy in Nepal. Maoist opposed it, saying there is security, implications on all that. Nepal shouldn't be supporting it. But ultimately, when it came to power, as a partner with the Nepali Congress, then Maoist supported it. So we see this kind of fluctuations on international relations. Mm. But yes, when they are in power, they have been supporting a kind of continuity in terms of, their relationship with America or India. Mm-hmm. Old view is US is an imperialist country and India is a expansionist country. But that is more on paper and more when they are in opposition than when they are ruling party. So what I'm saying is there is contradictions in what they say and what they do, and depends on whether they are in the opposition, they are in the government.
Mm-hmm. Yuvaraj, I want to continue on that point. So just for a little bit more context for our listeners, and also because I think this is one of the more, pardon me for the use of the word, but this is the best adjective, the more entertaining aspects of the election landscape in Nepal. So there has been quite a bit of conflict between the CPN Unified Marxist-Leninist and the CPN Maoist Center. So correct me if I'm wrong, but these parties back in the election that happened in 2017, they were a coalition and then the coalition broke apart. And there was an agreement for there to be power sharing regarding the position of prime minister. And that agreement did not, it changed or it did not go forward as it was originally agreed upon. And the reason why I think it's important to mention those two different points is because the CPN UML and the CPN Maoist Center, they both released their own respective papers about what the other party did, and the papers were very accusatory. So I actually want to ask you a little bit about that. So you were talking about how there are some contradictions in the ways that the parties behave. And I want to ask you about your opinion regarding the conflict between these former coalition allies and what the implications are for the people on the ground. Because in some cases, like, these party splits happen or these coalitions dissolve because of, like, real disagreement on policy. And sometimes they dissolve because of personal disagreements. So I would like to ask for you to talk about that with us and our listeners.
Thank you. Very, very interesting and very complete. Yes, in 2017, there was pre-election alliance between the, I'll say, Maoist and UML to save time. They will contest election on one single, on their, you know, like, as alliance partner, which they did, and they almost got 2/3 majority. And subsequently, they merged and formed a new party called Communist Party of Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the understanding there seemed to be, prime minister, Oli would first be the prime minister. Then at the end of 2.5 years, Maoist leader Prachanda will be the prime minister, which Oli never honored. And Nepal, you know, interestingly, Nepal's politics is more about power and personality than an agenda, almost without exception. Why I'm saying this is, you know, when, because Nepal, except that 2017 elections, other elections were in an instable parliament, hung parliament, there has been rotation of prime ministers. But each time they form coalition government, they decide who is going to be the prime minister after this. So, but they have never formulated common minimum program that would be the basis to run the government. That's why I'm saying it's basically power-centric and personality-oriented politics. So in this case also, Prachanda and Oli had that understanding. I think Oli didn't honor it. Then there were problems. Then MCC came as a trigger point, because MCC had been signed way back in 2018 between government of Nepal and the US State Department. They never placed it in parliament for approval, which was necessary under that agreement. So the rift began within the, you know, like, two constituents of the Communist Party when this was registered in Parliament Secretariat for debate and endorsement in the House. The Maoist side was opposed to it. And in the meantime, there were rifts emerging on basically about the, you know, like, about the manner of manner of conduct on the part of Oli, that he was not very respectful to people and leaders who didn't, you know, like, concur with him. And there were more serious charges labeled about corruption charges, about Nepal, compromising on its non-aligned foreign policy and signing the MCC, which they interpreted, rebels or within the UML, they interpreted it as Nepal's shift towards Indo-Pacific block. So the problem began from here. And when Oli was not handing over power to Prachanda, the Maoist group also joined that criticism. At this point, I think visibly, for the first time, I said right at the beginning that China normally would not indulge in Nepal's internal politics, but Chinese ambassador at the time was very visibly trying to bring about a patch-up between, you know, warring sides, Communist Party, but that she failed in that mission and the party, you know, broke away. Also, during that time, a Supreme Court decision saying that this merger of the two parties was unconstitutional, led to, you know, breakup of the party. And as a result, ultimately, the Maoist side and the rebels within UML, they joined hands with the Nepali Congress, and Sherbahadur Deuba became the prime minister. And this also created a big constitutional row in Nepal, because Oli had tried to dissolve parliament twice. He dissolved parliament twice, four times. The Supreme Court held that this was unconstitutional. And thus, party with two-third majority in parliament was reduced to minority, and the leadership went to another party. And so now there's too much bitterness between two communist parties, I mean Maoist and UML. And that's why Maoist and Nepali Congress are on one side. But, you know, like if you go or analyze the nature of Nepal's political parties, what I see is most likely, you know, this parliament would be a hung one with no one getting in. And also, given the nature of, given the kind of nature of this electoral process, it's very likely that all the three major parties would have lesser seats in this, in the parliament. Maybe it will come, RPP, that Rashtriya Prajanta Party will gain some more seats and all that. When the three major parties have, you know, like lost their current strength, then there is a likelihood that their leaders will come under criticism within their respective parties. For instance, Gagan Thapa is a young leader and former minister. He's contesting election, and he's saying that he'll be the prime ministerial candidate if the party wins, Nepali Congress. So that means a challenge to Sherbahadur Deuba's leadership. Similar thing might happen in Prachanda's party and Oli's party. Prachanda has changed his parliamentary constituency this time. This has kind of resulted in a visible demoralizing effect in the party. Why did our leader run away from the constituency that he had represented earlier? So all these cases might lead to a situation, the possibility of these parties losing their current strength might trigger internal, you know, like dissensions. In that case, the leaders will have two options. One, you know, like allow a democratic kind of transition of the leaders owning responsibility for loss of seats in their party under their leadership, or then go for another rise, or say, for instance, Prachanda and Oli coming together and again saying that, okay, you know, we led the party, we contested the election, we must respect it, we are not going to quit our leadership. That also is a possibility, because, as I said, it's all about power and personality. And our leaders don't seem to be accepting the defeat and taking responsibility for that so easily.
I want to ask a question about what happens in the lives of everyday citizens when these upheavals are happening in government. So you mentioned it's all about power and it's all about politics. So in what happens to the people on the ground while the people in the legislature are doing this?
Yeah, very interesting question. Yeah, I'll explain it this way. You know, like, unfortunately, parliament exists, but no serious issues are debated there. No due process or established process or good practices of parliament elsewhere are followed in Nepal. I'll give you just one example. In 2015, when Nepal promulgated its constitution, you know, like not a single provision of the constitution was debated in the full house. Not a single, a single amendment was moved. That was... And members hadn't even read the draft of the constitution. They were asked to, they were whipped to raise their hands. They adopted the constitution, which is, which is the constitution that prevails in the country today, but never allowed any kind of amendment, debate. So democracy is not only label, it's all about the process also.
Mm-hmm.
And the top leaders, they compromise on certain things. They said, we don't have to go for this larger debate, let's have it adopted. And that's why this constitution has not been not been very educated. There are many, many inadequacies. So this is a sad thing to happen.
Mm-hmm. So
what I'm saying is, so parliament exists, mm-hmm. but parliament failed to make executive accountable towards
mm-hmm.
it, which mm-hmm. is basically the spirit of any democratic constitution.
Mm-hmm. I love that comment, as in so concise. So I'm going to have to, I have to continue our conversation about our discussion about the other players. So it's not just the left and the progressive parties that are in this race. Like, we also have other players like Hindu nationalists and even yeah. royalists. And given that there are ethnic minorities in Nepal, can you talk a little bit about the impact they have on politics, or if they have any, if there's any significant developments happening in the country related to them?
Yeah, surely. That's a very important question. In Nepal, as I said right at the beginning, very diverse ethnicity-wise. There are 125 ethnic groups in a country with 30 million population. And normally, in this mixed system, or PR, proportional representation system of elections, you know, that ethnicity gets some kind of weight. People also vote, you know, on the basis of their ethnicity, and they get representative. They're represented also. But what happens is, certain ethnic groups, which are in extreme minority or on the verge of extinction, there is absolutely no chance of their getting, you know, elected or represented in parliament. You know, like normally when you talk about underprivileged or numerical minority getting represented, that is the spirit of positive discrimination. That, you know, those who cannot otherwise be elected should get a chance. But Nepal is the other, when they chose this electoral system, those with bigger, you know, like number, those ethnic groups, they will get representative, but not the one with the minimum numbers. That is one defect. And secondly, when they get elected, or any ethnic group, but they belong to political parties, and the whip system is so strong there, anyone, they cannot exercise, like in the US, members can take independent decision at times when they think it's very important, you know, like, but they are not allowed that. They are whip to vote certain ways. Defiance would result in annulment of their membership of parliament or their disqualification as member. So there is also a very major fault in this. Despite wider representation of ethnic groups, they cannot do much for the benefit of their ethnic groups or principle and policies they believe in.
Since you've already laid out many of the issues, can you also describe or what's the efforts, especially on in terms of issues on anti-corruption in the country going forward? Is that going to be a big factor into the election? And are there, so that's the first question. And then the second question is, are there any individual candidates that you think are bright spots or rising stars in Nepali politics that you think people can get behind or have a huge trust and are hopeful for?
Yes, about corruption, there is a campaign going on which is called No Not Again. Basically, they have identified some top leaders, held them responsible for the mess that the country is in and for the, you know, like rise in corruption. without accountability. I think it's going to have some kind of impact on the electoral outcome that there is this campaign against corruption. Although Nepal has also many constitutional bodies, internal mechanism to fight corruption, but you know they have not been very effective. There is an institution called Commission of Inquiry into Abuse of Authority, which deals with corruption and abuse of authority. But this has not been effective. The allegation against it is that it has not been able to look into or investigate into the cases involving big shots, which is true. And third, you know, what happened after the 2006 political change, it was a very euphoric moment. It came with opportunities, but since leaders couldn't manage it, they bungled it to the extent that they filled up all the constitutional bodies which were supposed to be acting fairly, impartial in all that, with the handpicked people who belong to their political parties. So the constitutional bodies, constitutional bodies lost their credibility and people's trust. That is the reason why this corruption kept rising. Absence of accountability became norms of the governance. And third, and more important thing was, the cabinet decided that any policy decision cannot be investigated by this anti-corruption body. And when they took this decision, they literally, tried to give an impression and succeeded that any decision, any policy corruption cannot be investigated, because anything that the cabinet decides become a policy issue and policy corruption cannot be investigated. And that has made corruption corruption all pervasive and dominant, a cancer that cannot be fought by the state agencies. But as I told you at the beginning, the no not again and this kind of public spirit or campaign has made corruption an issue in this election, and I think this will have an impact. That is the first question Ms. Carlo, you raised. And the second was, yes, any election comes with hope. Any election comes with organized determination of the people that we are not going to give up. You are our leaders, but we want to hold you accountable for what you promised and didn't do. And for did. I think this is going to be an assertive election. This will create some problems for the top leaders. And as I told you, there are young leaders coming up in the political parties and saying that we want to lead this country. Interestingly, let me add it here, that Nepal's 17.9 million voters population and 30 million total population, people above 65 years of age are only about 5% of the population. And so people, between 70, above 70 are covered under the social security scheme. And the top three, all the three top aspirants from the prime minister say, belong to that 70 and above category who are covered mm-hmm. this social security scheme. And 34% of the people are below 14. Now, the working population, say for instance, Nepal's working population is up to 60% of the total. And that has not been represented age-wise. So there is also resentment that more dynamic, energetic young people should be replacing the top leaders as, you know, like in important executive posts in the country, that these elections might be, you know, like we might see some things after this election where the challenge against the leaders will, leaders, existing leaders of all the parties will come after that.
All right. Yuvraj, I want to pivot back to something that you mentioned earlier, which was the mention of Nepal's neighbors. So do you think that this election will have any significant effects on the relationship with Nepal between China or between India, or maybe affect regional dynamics even?
Yes, surely. You know, what we've seen, you know, when a country is not able to manage its, you know, like changes and opportunity, a crisis become larger. In 2006, when Nepal, you know, like had that massive radical changes, what happened that time was India took the lead role in Nepal's internal change and setting major agenda like, you know, like federalism, secularism, republic. There was not a wider debate inside the country in parliament. So what happened was when India took lead role and brought European Union and US on board, China became very suspicious at that point, given, you know, like Tibet next door, its South Valley, and increased presence of US and EU. Then China started increasing its presence and investment in Nepal to the extent that it became the biggest foreign direct investment provider in Nepal for 4 years in a row. And post-President Xi Jinping's visit to Nepal in 2019, China again is a huge of course, COVID came as a setback, but he promised to invest in four major sectors, say, for instance, energy, trade and investment, tourism and hospitality, and post-construction. They cover huge areas. When you invest so much, then obviously you would need a favorable regime to protect your increased interest in investment. That is exactly what has been happening. And post 20th Congress, China is, I think, more ambitious in terms of developing its, ties with the neighbors. And given the presence, larger presence of India, US, and European in Nepal, China is going to play a larger role also. So I think there'll be, Nepal literally has become a playground of international forces.
Mm-hmm.
Post-election, depends which party or whose leaders leads the government. Because unfortunately, what we have seen is Nepal always in principle believed in a diplomacy of balanced relations with two neighbors, pursuing non-aligned foreign policy, and not belonging to any, security bloc. But post-MCC, Nepal also voted in the UN condemning Russia, for its attack on Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Ready to the position that Nepal's two neighbors took, China and India, a position of neutrality. So in certain quarters are saying that maybe China, Nepal is getting slightly MCC, Ukraine voting pro-US. That's a fear. Although Nepali Congress came out, it's very, very clearly stated in its manifesto that Nepal doesn't belong to any security bloc, but there are apprehensions. And only in the past, when India launched a, economic blockade for 5 months from 2015 September, he developed very cordial ties to the extent of signing trade and transit agreement with China. And so Oli is more seen as that way, in a very pro-China, and India is very suspicious towards him. And Prachanda keeps shifting his stance. But, you know, whenever the Maoist party is a bit down, then he comes out with some, tries to revive those revolutionary messages. And, you know, like sometimes changes US interference in Venezuela and all that. So we are not very consistent as a country in our foreign policy approach. And almost every political party or every leader seem to have a different foreign policy approach that creates a very volatile situation. Although Nepal's continued stance from the past up till now is, we need to increase our level of interdependence, and Nepal needs to, Nepal needs to increase its self-reliance, and at the same time, Nepal needs to make its interdependence with neighbors and other countries dignified, equality in spirit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Yuvaraj, thank you so much. So this has been such an informative conversation, and we're very excited. And we're also excited for you, and we have our fingers crossed for the holding and the outcomes of the election. So I think we've covered everything that we would have wanted to cover in this episode about the upcoming elections in Nepal. So Yuvaraj, thank you so, so much. This was very informative, and we hope our listeners enjoyed listening to this conversation and that a lot was learned, because there's also quite a bit that is, I think, applicable regardless of the regime or regardless of the country. So we wish you all the best for the further development of political maturity and democracy. And so we're going to now come to the part of the program that we give to all of our guests. So we're going to give the floor to you now. So if there's anything that you would like to promote, given that, you know, you are still currently an active journalist, as well as any message you would like to share with the audience. So the floor is all yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, we've covered most part of, the election-related, possibilities and the current scenario. This is certainly going to be a very important election, but this is also going to be a kind of, opportunity for people to give a lesson to their leaders that what they promised in 2006 was a stable Nepal politically, a Nepal with its democracy consolidated and economic prosperity promised. So they had also said there won't be any, corruption would be very rigorously dealt with. But what we have seen is just the opposite. It has affected Nepal's image in the international community. Nepal's passport is not treated very, respectfully when Nepalese travel abroad. And Nepal's economic prospect is, despite all the potential it has, very rich country in hydro, electricity and all that, it has not been able to, do as much as the leaders promised and people expected. So this is time that these elections will hold these leaders accountable. And secondly, Nepal's peace process and Nepal's political change are interlinked, because as I said at the beginning, when Maoist came to the, peace and democratic process, simultaneously a peace accord was signed. And one of the major, provisions and promise made by the peace process was that, justice would be done to the victims from both sides, both the state and the Maoist. Mm. Justice has not yet been done. Although Maoist leaders are in power, they have not been held accountable, either side, what I mean is. So, in peace without justice is something that doesn't make democracy stronger. Democracy is also all about justice, social justice, equality, you know, like to all. And we cannot expect a large section, we cannot expect two sides of the conflict, their leaders exercising or enjoying all power, and those who fought for the change and, you know, like got damaged physically in other ways, not getting justice. So this will make democracy very unstable. And third, and the most important thing for this election is that spirit of accountability that democracy talks about has to be, you know, like brought in practice, has to be executed and implemented. And fourth, from my side, you know, like when we talk about elections as very important component of democracy, periodic election, we also need to have very independent judiciary as one strong, you know, like proof that democracy exists in that country, that when there is, you know, like people have certain grievances, when state becomes atrocious, people need to get justice and they look up to, you know, like judiciary for that justice. But unfortunately, in the moment of euphoria of change in 2006, Nepal judiciary has also become partisan in the sense that, you know, in judges' appointment system was very faulty. Political parties started picking up, you know, people from who were loyal to their parties as judges. So it has become a partisan justice. It has become a corrupt practice, a corrupt justice system. And so this is an issue that people have been raising in public forum, public debate. And but political parties, whenever they are angry with certain judges, they move the impeachment motion against them, but not in a fair manner, not in a transparent manner, not in a manner that the Constitution expected. So these are malaise. These are, you know, basically the shortcomings or aberrations, I'd say, that Nepal's democracy has been saying. We want a very effective democracy and where with all its, you know, like meaning being translated into action, we hope that this election would be an opportunity for the people to assert and to give a very clear message to the political parties, behave, because no power than the people is supreme in enforcing democracy in any country and enforcing its prestige in inside the country and you know, like across the world. I think this is this much I'll be saying at this moment.
Yubaraj, thank you so much. So that was wonderful, like really great insights and recommendations as well as hopes for the upcoming election and the citizens of Nepal. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your time, your expertise. And we hope to have you with us again soon.
Yes,
like maybe
definitely.
We can record
hopefully,
another one after the
hopefully
results
after
of the election.
After the elections. And if I may just
thank
add,
you
Mr.
so much.
Yubaraj,
it was real honor that
if I may also add one thing to what you said, to the Nepalese, go out and vote.
Yes,
that's the most important part. So yeah,
yes, I think we'll see that. Thank you.
I enjoyed that. I mean, it was entertaining, it was engaging. The parallels made me a little bit sad because, you know, it sucks to know that, you know, personality politics are a thing all over the world, but, you know, solidarity is all about, well, shared experience is part of solidarity.
Yubaraj mentioned, though, that the about the elections and the problems that they're facing is really, as you said, is very familiar with what's happening here and in other countries in Asia. And I'm really just, you know, interested in finding out if this election will, you know, because will determine the future of Nepal in the coming years, especially because this period of democracy is still very early. It's at least less than 2 decades old. And, you know, people are concerned with, will this affect the stability of the country? And at least with what he's saying is, you know, there's still hope, especially with younger people coming up, you know, exacting accountability or demanding their leaders to be more, for the lack of a better term, responsible in their politics.
Mm-hmm. I really hope that, like he mentioned earlier, that, you know, there's always hope every time there's an election that is upcoming. And so the situation that he portrayed with regard to the corruption, the political instability from the infighting in the parties and the coalitions, I can only hope that things get better from here, because the thing that he said earlier, I mean, I'm sorry, it was such a goat comment, such a based comment, that, wait, where, what was it? I was taking notes. There, unfortunately, Parliament exists. I relate so hard to that, because, yeah, I mean, I think it's just such a common experience for citizens where, you know, people are fighting in the halls of legislature and nothing is happening for the citizens who live in the country. And, you know, let's hope that that changes.
Yeah, definitely. Especially, you know, because for disclosure, we have members of Sokdem Asia, of course, our member party there is Nepali Congress, and you know, we hope the best, although there's, of course, every democracy has its imperfection, but we're looking forward that, you know, going into the elections, all these parties, the different parties, come together and settle the differences and work on the real problems of Nepal, not just, you know, the interpersonal, you know, as you said, very personalistic kind of politics, but focus really on the issues at hand.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Let's monitor. So I'm not sure yet when this episode will be released, but we're recording it on the 13th. We have like about a week before the elections will happen. So fingers crossed, we'll be monitoring the election results as they come in. And hopefully if we do end up having another episode with you, Baraj, it's going to be a happy yep. episode. So yep. I want to thank all of our listeners. We hope that you enjoyed this episode about the upcoming elections in Nepal this 2022. And if you have an election happening in your community that you would like us to talk about, and if you have a guest in mind, like, please feel free to let us know. Our email address can be found on the description of the podcast.
Oh, also don't forget to follow us on our Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe. We're on Spotify and other podcasting platforms.
Mm-hmm. Please do rate our program. We hope that you enjoy it, and just let
five,
us know.
Five other... stars.
Yes.
Yes.
Five let stars. Us know the things that you want to listen to and the things that we do that you want to hear more of, and maybe episode ideas that you don't really like, just so that we can have some input about where we can take the show moving forward. So, Carlo, it was such a good time recording this episode with you, and it's always a pleasure to do these programs for our listeners. So I want to thank you again. I am your host, and this is the Sokdem Asia Podcast. My name is Cassie.
And I'm Carlo.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.